been really a great workshop. It's a great week, and I'm very happy and very glad that you invited me to come. So when you told me about the well, subject of the talk, so there was this idea that this should be something informal, an informal workshop with time for discussion, and so on. So I thought that I would give, instead of a normal polished presentation of results already achieved, I would do something that is more informal. I will be mostly using the Blackboard. I will show some transparencies for support, some slides. But this is going to be an open-ended talk. So I'll stop whenever my chairman tells me that he's had enough, that he doesn't take anymore, or whenever I see that you're getting bored to tears. Because I have more stuff to talk about than you have patience to endure and to endure it. So. Yeah, okay. So, well, please stop me at any point. I'll be happy if I only get to the first of my pages, handwritten pages, and then the discussion takes the rest of the time, because that's the point of it, to discuss ideas and well, to have some lively interaction with you guys. So what I'm going to talk about is possible relation between the physics of black strings and the physics of liquid jets. Sometimes I like to say that, well, you know, string theory is a theory of everything, so it should be a theory that unifies black holes and inkjet printers. So that's what I'm going to try to do. I mean, it's all black, right? I'm wearing the appropriate shirt. So it's something. Some of the things that I'm going to talk about are based on work that I've done with my students Joan Camps and Nidal Haddad in Barcelona. Well, he's not my student anymore. He's a postdoc in Durham moving to Cambridge. And some of the ideas that I'm going to discuss are, well, something that we're trying to do with them and also with Unpei Miyamoto in Japan. So I want to establish a relationship between black strings and liquid jets. Liquid jets. So this belongs to the subject of this workshop, because I want to establish a relationship between a gravitating system and a gravitating system with a black hole, and a system that doesn't have any gravity. So it's a holographic type of correspondence. But it's somewhat different from other talks in this workshop in that this relationship is not going to involve in the gravitational side any ADS space. I'm going to work mostly in vacuum gravity and with solutions that are asymptotically flat, at least in directions transverse to the black string. Okay? So it's not ADS, but there's holography, a holographic connection between the gravitating system and the non-gravitating system. And also I'm going to try to use this relationship, not in the direction of trying to use the gravitational system in order to learn about the non-gravitating one, which is what we've heard mostly in the previous talks. What I want to do is to learn from fluid dynamics, I want to learn about the physics of the gravitating system. So we know that these dualities, these correspondences, they cut both ways. So I'm going to use the correspondence to go from here to there. Okay. In particular, the system that I want to understand, the phenomenon that I want to understand, is the instability of black strings. This is the Gregor-Laplan instability in terms of instabilities, related instabilities of liquid jets. Okay. So probably most of you have seen this. This is not my work, obviously. It's numerical work done by Louis and Franz. So this is a black string. You put some perturbation, and it does. This is what you get after an expensive supercomputer numerical simulation of the system that took years to develop. and they came up with this beautiful video, which you can see in YouTube. Okay. So this is the evolution of the gravitational system. I guess that all of you are probably familiar or have seen this something like this before, right? You know what's going on in here. Does anyone need a clarification of? Yeah. So I mean, it becomes these blobs. So you have bigger blobs, then smaller blobs, satellite blobs, and then thin tubes connecting them. And they don't see any end to this. So they run this, I guess, until their code crashes, because you lose accuracy. But there doesn't seem to be any end to this. This formation of satellites and this formation of this, well, this thinning of the tube goes on. And eventually, well, if you're in a gravitational system with a Planck scale, at some point you will reach Planckian curvatures, and quantum gravity should take over. Okay. Your patients crashed.
It's an accident that should have taken like 8 more months.
Okay, yeah. So it's a matter of patience. That's it's good to know. But in any case, so it's clear that well, your patients crashed because you were seeing satellites. Sorry.
His old fault. Yeah. Okay.
So why would there be a correspondence between black strings and asymptotic?
Well, first of all, if you have a look at this, this looks very much like what you see in a fluid. So if you, these are pictures of real fluids. So this is a little falling from a faucet. This is a fluid evolving in time. Well, in fact, it's there's fluid. This is two fluids. So you have fluids with different densities and different properties. One of them is the lighter fluid, and the other is the darker fluid. And this is what you see from an experiment. So if this doesn't remind you of what you've just seen in the video, then there's clearly something similar going on. Whether we can make this similarity more precise, this is what I want to discuss. Okay. In fact, if you have this is a picture from their paper. This is a picture from a fluid dynamical paper, a paper in fluid dynamics, where you have real fluid, glycerol in this case. Now, similarities are obvious, right?
So what's this deep water, my friend?
You just Google it up and then you will see. Water can flow or it can crash. Yeah, Google it up. Yeah, you have a gadget there. So you will see. Okay, so that's a kind of a inspiration to this talk, to this research program.
Okay, but it's not like you're going to try to read anything at any boundary.
We don't have a boundary
anymore.
So. Boundary? What boundary?
Like in ADS.
I don't have ADS, but I have a boundary. You have a string with a boundary at asymptotic infinity, a black string. And that's where my fluid is going to live. So, well, why I'm interested in this? I mean, this is not just that there is this connection. Also, that in this gravitating problem, what they discovered is that the cosmic censorship seems to be violated, and that's interesting. As you know, cosmic censorship is a statement about how fast one can get to a quantum gravity regime, whether you can do it in a classical timescale or in a quantum, much longer quantum timescale. So cosmic censorship is something that's interesting, and it may, I mean, if there are extra dimensions, in particular if there are large extra dimensions, this may have experimental consequences. Cosmic censorship that can happen only if you have additional dimensions. Okay. So that's one of the things that I want to understand. So they had a numerical simulation, which was impressive, but it's one numerical simulation for one particular case, fixed number of dimensions. I guess that doing it in other dimensions, it's possible, but then you have to study things case by case. And so we'd like to have a kind of a deeper understanding of what's going on, why cosmic censorship is violated, how it's violated, how you approach the point where this fluid or this string is getting thin enough that it reaches the Planck scale. We want to understand the approach to this formation of this singularity. And well, what I want to know is whether I can have some analytical understanding of it and something that can be extrapolated to other systems. Because this, I think, so this instability, it's a kind of a paradigm for instability of horizons. So it would be good if we could understand it in quite in more generality and learn something general about gravity in general and about the possible formation of naked singularities. Okay. So what I want to do is to find a hydrodynamic theory for this. This is the hydrodynamic way to the Gregor-Lafrenière instability. And there are different aspects of this process that we may want to understand using hydrodynamics. The first and the simplest thing is to try to understand the linearized instability of the black string using fluid dynamical methods. This is what's known in hydrodynamics, the Rayleigh plateau instability, or plateau Rayleigh, or Rayleigh. So this is something that's known since the 19th century, that fluid jets are linearly unstable. And in the gravitational side, of course, this is the Gregory-Laplan instability. So the question is whether at the linearized problem we can establish a connection a connection between the two systems. And this is something that I think we've done, at least to some extent, that we have a fairly good understanding of how this works at the linearized level. Then the next thing that you would want to do is to understand not just the instability at the linearized level, but go nonlinear. Can we understand the nonlinear evolution of this gravitating system using a hydrodynamic theory? Well, this is much less clear that whether we can do it or not. So this is still open, and this is something that I want to discuss here today, why there are obstacles to doing this. Another problem that you may want to understand using hydrodynamic methods is the, what I would call the approach to the singularity. Whether this thinning of the neck that we have here, situation in these two regions seems to be strikingly similar. So can we make this more precise? Can we use the theory that people in fluid dynamics use for drop formation? Can we import it to the gravitational side? I think that this is something that we can do. So it's something that we haven't done, but I'm... So there are different experiments that people perform. Sometimes they let something drop from a faucet. You may worry that in that case you have a gravity, which is something that's pulling the fluid apart. But it turns out that one can discuss, one can fairly easily see that gravity, at the when you have when you're in a regime where you're forming this thin neck, gravity is essentially negligible, that the process is dominated by the surface tension and the viscosity of the fluid, viscosity and inertia. So even if gravitational forces are present when you do this, you may also have a fluid jet that you, I mean, like in an inkjet printer. So you send a fluid jet, and then it's going to break up into the droplets. And that's a system where the dynamics is essentially controlled by other forces rather than gravitation. So it's essentially controlled by the inertia of the fluid, the viscosity of the fluid, and capillarity. That's the surface tension of the.
So speaking about viscosity, so do you have, is this picture generic? If I start looking at fluids with different viscosity?
So things can change. So if you have different values for the viscosity and the capillarity, then you get different regimes as you approach the formation of this neck. So in some fluids, if the viscosity is very low, then experimentally you don't get to see this. But theoretically, you know that eventually you're going to get to a regime where you have something like this. So in some cases, what you have is that the fluid develops something more like a conical neck, something like this. there's some stage where you let the fluid evolve and it develops a conical neck. But then this is because I think that in this case viscosity is not sufficient, it hasn't kicked in yet, but you can argue that when this neck becomes sufficiently thin, then viscosity will kick in and then you will get something that's more similar to this, even if the scale at which this happens, maybe a scale of distance is too short to be resolved with a microscope, and the time scale for the evolution may be too large for you to resolve with your camera, high-speed camera, or whatever you use, right? So the idea that that's important here is that the process of this breakup, this is controlled by an attractor, an attractor of the fluid equations. So it's something that's universal. This attractor, you may reach the attractor through a complicated trajectory in your space of solutions, and that's going to depend on what's the value of the parameters in your system, but eventually you're going to get to that attractor, and that's what's going to control the breakup. Mm-hmm. This existence of an attractor for drop formation is something that was important in the when people were studying inkjet printers, because something that they found is that so they send a jet of ink, this breaks into droplets, but then they found that there are satellite droplets forming, and this was bad for the printer because it blurred the image. And they were trying to control, well, to reduce this effect by changing the parameters, the initial parameters in how you throw this this jet. And they couldn't control it. I mean, the satellites were always forming. And the explanation is that this is controlled by an attractor. It's something that you cannot do much about. You change your initial conditions, you're always going to end up forming these satellites. So this is something that people discovered experimentally in the 70s, the engineers developing inkjet printers. And it was only explained in the early 90s that, well, this this theory of drop formation is controlled by an attractor. Yes?
The correspondence that you have there, in principle, should not forget the contact.
It's not, it's everything, it's at the classical level, yeah.
Right, but you're saying that you would like to see the approach to the singularity, but then quantum effects.
Eventually, yeah, just like in fluid dynamics, you have molecular dynamics
right.
controlling the breakup.
But molecular dynamics is supposedly, I think, very different from what we expect from...
Yes. So, but the idea is that since this process is controlled by an attractor, the way that you get there, that's something that you can understand classically. Then at some point, quantum gravity is going to take over. And well, in fluids, what happens is that the fluid neck is thin enough that it evaporates. Here, I think that one can argue that what happens is that the black hole horizon is small enough that it evaporates. Hawking evaporation. So the same process that controls the endpoint of Hawking evaporation is, I think, controlling the endpoint of this instability. And also, it's not only this that you have an attractor leading you to this point, but in fluid dynamics, people have argued that there's also an attractor leading you away from this point. So once this has broken, there's an attractor controlling how this part detaches from the bigger blob. I think that if there's such an attractor also in the gravitational system, then you have an attractor, a classical attractor taking you to one point, a classical attractor taking you away from that point. Then there's a small regime where you have to invoke quantum gravity, where you have to invoke molecular dynamics. But I mean, you only the whole process of the breakup, quantum gravity is just a tiny detail that you need in order to affect the breakup of the.
Because you're saying there's an attractor on the other side, so whatever quantum gravity does, it will still look rapid.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you.
So this is saying that, I mean, this is something that we can hope to have a good understanding of. Even, I mean, you can put here your favorite theory of quantum gravity. What I'm claiming is that the way that this theory of quantum gravity resolves the endpoint of Hawking evaporation is also going to resolve the point of breakup of the string.
On the fluid side, that's
yes.
Cavitation.
I'm not sure. I don't think I understand cavitation enough to say, but in the papers that I read about this, they don't mention cavitation. So I don't think, I don't think that cavitation plays much of a role. But this is just to say that I prefer not to have to learn more about cavitation. Doesn't seem to be relevant, at least in the fluid literature. And I've scanned the theory of dog formation in quite a lot of detail. They don't invoke anything about cavitation. Yes?
So you started out by talking about singularities forming on a classical timescale. But a black string already has, you know, sort of an existing singularity inside it, formed presumably, you know, maybe like gravitational collapse or something. So, I mean, it is a classical timescale in that it's much faster than Hawking evaporation.
Yeah.
But you still, you know, you form the black string, and then you get a singularity after this cascade turns it into a bunch of small black holes.
Yeah.
But now that we know that in five dimensions cosmic censorship is violated, do you also expect that there will be processes where you can form an egg singularity directly? You know, you just gravitationally collapse some stuff, and boom, you just make a singularity not in the horizon?
I don't know. I don't have any candidate. I don't know if any process that in higher dimensions could get you a naked singularity without having a black hole involved.
Well, I think the way
it may be, but I
I think the way to cheat would be to do chopsticks.
You want something generic.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if any generic process that gives you cosmic censorship without having a black hole at the beginning.
Well, what about something like Shapiro and Tucholsky's spindle singularities? I mean, we know that doesn't really work in four dimensions. Is it possible it might work in five dimensions?
I don't know. I don't have anything to say about that.
What's a spindle singularity?
It's a kind of Z-bar-shaped distribution, and then you were basically fine-tuning that to find out that, and they were claiming that at the end points, essentially, would make it similar.
If you're allowing Hawking radiation process,
but that's a quantum time scale that's taking you there.
Of course it is, but I mean, it's just to say that if you start with, if you've got a compact dimension, you start with a black string that's stable, so you collide some matter form it, that's completely generic, and then it will always evaporate down to the point where you trigger the instability. Now, of course, that process is quantum, but it would be expected to be there, and so generically.
So, formation of singularities is something that we expect to happen on quantum timescales. So, in black hole evaporation, that's going to happen, right? So, you're going to get to a. But then the question is whether you can have it on a. I mean, the quantum timescale, that's enormous. Classical timescales, that's typically the light crossing time of the system, so that's much faster.
Sure, but it's just worth emphasizing that
physically. But I think I think it's a very good question, and it would be good to investigate whether there are classical processes in higher dimensions that can take you directly to a naked singularity without having to go through a black hole. But,
I mean, there are these processes involving colliding, closed colliding, bubbles of nothing, which do it. But you can also throw them out on there. They also have Hamiltonians, which are on that from below. So whether you take them seriously or not, is
okay.
But certainly speaking, classic process, you know, at least some examples.
Okay, good. So,
on the left side, you would expect at the end of this process to form an X scenario like you
mentioned.
What about on the fluid side? Obviously, we don't see that.
Well, the fluid description becomes singular. And you have that the thickness of the tube goes to zero, velocities go to infinity. The fluid description reaches a singularity.
Realistically, just splits.
Well, I mean, you never see the splitting. In the fluid, in order to affect the splitting, you have to get away from the fluid dynamical regime. Then you have some molecular dynamics. And then the thing is that after that, you can get back to the fluid dynamical regime because you're in an attractor trajectory. Okay.
Sorry, Roberto, just coming back to this, what you were writing about, I mean, in this, the plasma tubes of Minwala, then.
Of Minwala, Weissman, and Harani.
There's a precise map for the first two points. And I thought, was it Miyamoto?
I think that's interesting. I'm not going to say anything about that.
Yeah.
Because we have much less analytical control. I know that this is, we're trying to bring together here numerics and analytics. In that case, I think that all we know is from numerics. I think it's good to have, a problem where, so here, I mean, some other cases we're going from analytics to numerics. Here I'm trying to go from numerics to analytics because, I mean, they have given us a wonderful clue of some interesting physics lurking behind this system that we can maybe hope to understand analytically. I don't think that if we didn't have their numerical results, I wouldn't be trying to do this. But I mean, this is crying out for an explanation. So, so there is this, and then well, something that you've already discussed. That's a breakup. And beyond, this is what I just discussed when you have evaporation and then the attractor afterwards. So this is something I think that these 2 points. That's something that we can hope to have an analytical handle and understand it better, right? So I'm going to now to begin to discuss how we've come to understand this, at least at the linearized level, what we've done and how we've done it. So the correspondence, as I say, it's a kind of a holographic correspondence. I think that we understand by now very well when you have a correspondence between a gravitational system with a horizon and a fluid. And we know that this can work in a lot of generality, that you don't need to have anti de Sitter space to have a fluid gravity correspondence. We knew already that this wasn't necessary because there was the membrane paradigm from the late 70s, and this didn't involve anti de Sitter space. But we don't even, in the case of the membrane paradigm, the membrane lived on top of the horizon. We can have fluid gravity correspondences also away from the horizon in spaces which are not asymptotically ADS. So it's something that we can understand in quite a lot of generality. And I will be happy to discuss with if you want to know more about what's the bigger framework for understanding the correspondence between fluids and gravitating systems with a horizon. So the one that I'm going to focus on is the specific case where we have a black string and we want to describe its dynamics, at least parts, part of its dynamics in terms of a fluid description. Okay. But before I do that, I'm going to remind you of what is this linearized instability that I've been mentioning. So that's, again, black strings versus liquid jets. That's GL versus R. Gregor-Laplan versus Rayleigh-Platon. So the Gregor-Laplan stability, now we have this black string. Everything that I'm saying about black strings can be extended to black brains as well. But for simplicity, to keep things simpler, I will only discuss the black strings. So we have a black string with a horizon size that I call R0. This is a system with only one parameter. This is the only parameter in my solution. If I perturb it a little bit, then this develops ripples along the horizon, where the variation of the horizon, the size of the horizon, this is coordinate, see? This grows exponentially in time. This is an instability that appears only when your wavelengths are long enough. So it doesn't appear for modes for fluctuations of a very short wavelength. So you can plot a dispersion relation for unstable modes. And it looks something like this. So if your wavelengths are very short, that's a high wave number, the system is stable. At this point, you find a zero mode. So there's a mode with a zero frequency where you can have a static deformation of the black string. If your mode has a longer wavelength, then it's unstable and it grows exponentially with an imaginary frequency, which has a maximum kind of halfway in this wave number range. So in order to get these curves, what you have to do is take a the Einstein equations with a black string solution. Then you linearize the Einstein equations around this background, and then you solve the boundary value problem, which it's turned into a non-linear or into a, well, a generalized eigenvalue problem for these frequencies. You solve the equations numerically, you use some Schutting method or some spectral method, and then what you get, well, it's a curve like this. In more detail, these are actual numerical data from Pau Piveras. This n, the number of dimensions, is n plus 4, so this is a five-dimensional string. And as you change the number of dimensions, well, the instability is there. It's only that it gets to longer and longer wave numbers. That's shorter and shorter wavelengths. Okay, so this is something that you have to solve numerically. Now, is there any hope that we can do it analytically? Then we'll see that we can get a good understanding of these curves from a simple fluid dynamical model. But before I do that, so this was the Gregory-Laplan problem. Let me describe what is the Rayleigh plateau problem. In this case, you start from a liquid jet, a fluid with a bounding surface that has some surface tension. This fluid has some density, and it has some size that I'm going to call some thickness, R0 as well. Now, it's been known since the 19th century that if you perturb this, then this becomes unstable in a way that's similar to this one. So, something like this. Also for wavelengths that are sufficiently long. And the curves are more or less.
I mean, the fluid is not moving or anything.
You start with a fluid at rest. You go to the rest frame of the fluid if that's a liquid jet that you're drawing. So the curves look similar to this. The phenomenon looks similar. And in fact, this is what Oscar and Vitor realized. I don't know how they realized it, but maybe they said, well, I think I've seen this before. Let's go and check the literature on fluids, whether there's something similar. People in fluid dynamics, for some reason, only consider the case of three-dimensional fluids. They, Oscar and Vitor, they extended the calculations to higher dimensions. And, well, you see that there's striking similarity, right? So they have this plot, and you compare it to this plot, and you say, wow, maybe we're onto something. Okay. But at the level of what they did in their paper, this was an analogy. There was no systematic connection between the two systems. In fact, you can see this system is characterized by just a single scale. You only have the thickness of the black string, whereas in this case, you have at least three different parameters. So in order to make this comparison, you have to, well, try to see how these parameters could be related to the, well, try to guess what could be the relationship between the parameters in this system and this single parameter that you have there. You can say that, well, maybe the surface tension is related to the temperature of the black string, temperature, surface, gravity, that seems to have something to do with surface tension. So that's, I think, how you match the curves here. There's some arbitrariness in how you choose your numbers, because there's no way to...
Yeah, but there was also the paper by Smart, you know, giving a surface tension to the arrival.
But I mean, I think that that's something that it's unclear whether there's a connection between it. This is an analogy. This is at the level of an.
So the equations for small perturbations are different in both cases.
Yes, that's something that I'm going to get in more detail. So, well, for one thing, this is what the case that he treated is a non-relativistic fluid. This is a relativistic system, and this was an incompressible fluid. It's not clear whether this is compressible or not. Now, one can extend this analysis also to relativistic and compressible fluids. And then you can also get the dispersion relations. And, well, you get the same phenomenon, and you get a different curves. And then you might try to see whether there's one case that looks closer to the other.
In the fluid case, this is a solid cylinder.
it's a fluid cylinder.
Yeah, but it fills in the...
Yeah.
But if you want to think of this as the holographic version of that, it's going to be on a cylinder, not on a solid cylinder. Right?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to make this analogy between a fluid cylinder filled in, I think that you have to go to the plasma tubes. So this would be a plasma tube. The plasma tube would be related to a black string lying on the bottom of confining ABS.
And then you know all the tensions.
Yeah, in that case you can.
And you know the fluid dynamics.
Yeah, the problem is that you only know this numerically.
But are you going to go black holes at some point?
Yes, I am going to. Yeah, eventually. Yeah.
Sorry,
if I get to there. Yeah. Yes. this you can solve analytically. This you can solve exactly. Let me see if I the next transparency. No. So I mean, one of the things that you notice is that these curves, they look similar, but here, I mean, this goes more straight. It's more like a straight line than here. And in fact, if you analyze the details, if you expand around this point, there's a quadratic term here in K that is missing here. In order to get that, if you add viscosity, kinematic viscosity to this fluid, then these curves do something like this. Become more similar to the other ones. But then you're putting another parameter in the game that you have to fit.
And also, you're going to second order in this
one,
when you
stay
the first.
Yeah. Viscosity is something that, if you're close to this point, viscosity, for example, this point is not moved by viscosity because this is a zero mode, it's static, so viscosity doesn't affect. But it affects this. The curves with viscosity, you cannot get them analytically. You have to solve numerically, but it's not a terribly complicated problem.
You're still in the introduction, right?
Yeah. You might want to stay up a bit. Okay, yeah. So, do we have more than an analogy? Can we make this connection more precise? Well, there are different levels at which you might want to have this relation being more precise. I think that the relation can be made precise only in the limit where this liquid jet is in what's called the slender jet approximation. And the regime where this black string is described by what we call the black hole effective theory. Okay. So the thing is, so Vitor and Oscar have this relationship, this black string and liquid jet. They pointed out an analogy. Can we make this connection more than an analogy for the fluid, for the entire range of wavelengths in this problem? I don't think that you can do this. I don't think that you have anything more than an analogy at the level of black strings and liquid jets. But if you perform here a reduction to a black fold, here a reduction to a slender jet, both of these are 1+1 effective theories. I think that in this case we can have a precise connection.
Sorry, you're saying what you have been saying happens with liquid jets at small Reynolds numbers. Is it like far away from the
So if you have
it's like a
I think, well, in that case, so these curves.
So I think
it becomes something like this. The curves, if you have a
small Reynolds.
Small Reynolds. Uh-huh. Yeah, so it becomes, but that's probably not the regime that we want to study. Okay. So I think this connection can be made precise in the sense that we can derive out of the Einstein equations in a systematic controlled way, an effective 1+1 dimensional theory, and that this is going to belong in the same class as the theories that people use for fluids, describing them in the regime what they call the slender jet approximation, which is also a 1+1 effective description. So how do we get this 1+1 effective theory for the black string? This is where the black holes come in. So so we begin with a black string. Again, with thickness R0. Well, the solution is the reason that I'm using this n is because it's I prefer to write n here than other than d minus 4. So this is a solution I also like it to write. I like to write it in this way. This is the same solution, but I've written it. I've introduced here a velocity vector to describe velocity along the direction of the string. These coordinates sigma are the coordinates p and z, the directions along the wall sheet of the string. This is a time-like vector normalized to unit, so it's a velocity vector. If you take this u to be this one, you recover this form. If u is different, then what you have is a boosted black string. So I have this solution. And then one of the things that I can do is compute. I go to infinity. Here near infinity, well, if you have a black hole, then you can measure the mass at infinity. If you have a black string, you not only measure mass, but you measure energy density, but also component of pressure in the direction of the string. So you can compute the analog of the mass for an extended object. It's a stress energy tensor, which you could take to be the ADM type stress energy tensor or the quasi-local stress energy tensor of Brown and York. At infinity, they give the same result. So the stress energy tensor that you compute for this object has the following form. Has the form of a perfect fluid with an energy density. This is the energy density. This is the terms that the components of the stress energy tensor along the time direction. There's a number here. The number I'm going to omit, this is just the volume of the sphere divided by g. It's not quite important for us. And then the pressure is this. Okay. Another thing that you can do, so this is for the static solution, but one of the things that we've done is you perturb this string, you introduce a long wavelength fluctuation along the string, the horizon, you solve the equations, imposing that the perturbation remains regular at the horizon and that the solution is intuitively flat, and then you find a perturbed string, which gives you a corrected stress energy tensor. So it's a correction. If you're performing an expansion at long wavelengths, it's a correction that's come. It's going to come with a.
So you have the pressure with a different sign of the energy?
Yes. That's strange, right? This is sounding like the fluid is unstable. Exactly. So, but let me, before I get to that, so you can perturb this, you introduce fluctuations, you solve for the fluctuations, you compute now the corrections to the stress energy tensor that come from these fluctuations. The fluctuations are going to be proportional to derivatives of, in this case, the velocity field. This theta is the expansion of this velocity field. So you have an expansion in derivatives of the fluctuation, and it comes with a coefficient. And this coefficient, you interpret it as the bulk viscosity of this effective fluid, this is, you can write it, 1 minus, this is the entropy density for the stream. This is, again, another number times R0 times to the n plus 1. That's the area of these sections. This is the speed of sound. The derivative of the pressure with respect to the energy density, which in this case,
Okay.
Yes.
Negative pressure is precisely the signature connotation.
Okay, I mean,
because
maybe.
The vacuum has a higher pressure, it wants to go bubbles inside your fluid. And that
okay, but that's when you have a fluid with a surface. This is a 1 plus 1 fluid without any surface.
No, it wants to break because the.
It wants to break, yeah, yeah.
The vacuum wants to grow bubbles inside.
Okay, if you're telling me that the Gregor-Lafan instability is cavitation, I'm happy to use that term. It's an instability of a fluid that wants to clamp instead of. So
but that's precisely cavitation. So
okay, fine.
But in,
cavitation, I think that when you tend to have bubbles forming, this means that you have a surface tension.
No, this depends on the dimension. Here, a bubble is just a segment.
Okay, if you want to call this 1 plus 1 cavitation, fine. Don't have any problem with that. Okay? Yeah, I'm happy to know that it's cavitation, but I don't think. So if we're in higher dimensions, if we're in a fluid with a in a black brain with a higher dimensions, in that case we don't have a boundary for the surface for the fluid either. So if I have a black brain, I have negative pressure, but I don't form bubbles because I don't have a surface. The fluid is going to form clumps, but it cannot form bubbles.
No, I'm saying the vacuum, the other phase. The vacuum grows bubbles.
I don't have any other phase.
Yes, you do.
No. No, I mean, this fluid is everything there is. It's not that the fluid is inside some ambient.
No, I understand that, but here you have a black stream.
Yes.
If you replace the black stream by vacuum, that's the other phase.
I think his fluid is 1 plus 1 dimension.
But,
yeah. No, I understand that. This has nothing to do with the dimension. Cavitation is just a statement that you have a system with two possible phases, and the phase you're looking at has lower pressure than the other one. So the other one grows, wants to grow bubbles inside the one you have. That's the instability. If you have surface tension, that can only happen if you grow big enough a bubble, because then the volume wins over the surface.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. It will all eventually win.
Yeah, but I don't think I. Get,
I see that you have a negative speed of sound squared.
Yes.
But you can have systems that have that without negative pressure. That's a different instability. But
yeah, that's
the negative pressure.
Yeah. Really yeah.
With cavitation, it's you spontaneously create these bubbles, right? Whereas here,
yeah, this is not
the rate of spontaneous nucleation of the true vacuum is infinite.
But I don't have any true vacuum here.
Well, even if you didn't have true vacuum there, I think the rate of
if you break up the stream,
yes,
in the region where you don't have
well,
stream,
I get out of the hydrodynamic regime.
Yes,
that's where to begin with.
Cavitation precisely predicts the breakup of hydrodynamics. That's the way when you have a moving fluid, for example, the correction from viscosity corrects the pressure and gives you negative pressure, and that predicts the breakdown of hydrodynamics.
That's okay. People in fluid dynamics don't describe this as cavitation.
Well, but they also don't do higher than 3 dimensions.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe you should go ahead.
Yes.
You introduced the long wavelength.
Yes.
Mode. Are you going to be able to reconstruct all of the curve?
I'm going to get to this. Okay. Of course, this is a relationship that you know well,
right.
Because I think that you were
right.
The first
so
person
surprised.
To.
I,
yeah. It's not surprising that one gets this.
Yeah, can you give couple sentences? Why
yeah, so, well, the way we obtained it with Joan Camps and Nidal Haddad was by explicit calculations. But I think that there's a way of recovering it by mapping this system to the AEDS system. That's a kind of thing that Kostas Kenderis and collaborators have been doing. So it's a kinematic connection between bulk viscosity and shear viscosity, even if in this case you don't have shear viscosity because this is a 1+1 fluid. But if you consider black brains, in that case it's something that follows so the fact that you have
eta
over two eta, 1 over p minus p squared, where p is the dimension of the p brain, and this is the shear viscosity. This is something that should follow kinematically.
You were saying that you can think of this as embedded in.
One can have a mapping between the two systems. Right. It's not that it's embedded, but there's a mapping between the two systems.
So this TAD is just a Van Dirk stress tensor on the.
Yes. Yes. And it's measured at asymptotically flat infinity in this direction. I don't have any obstruction to doing this. Having to do with the fact that I'm not in ADS nor anything. It's something that I can do. And it's
again, in principle, it's because it's a derivative expansion, there will be lots of additional corrections.
Yeah, there are additional corrections, which we didn't compute explicitly, but they have been computed in ADS. And now there's a, well, one can recover out of the results in ADS the corrections for this in asymptotically flat. So, as you pointed out, this is unstable because I have a negative speed of sound, which means that if I introduce, so if I take this, I introduce a sound wave, that's a long wavelength perturbation of this string, where I perform a fluctuation, I make the pressure fluctuate. A fluctuation in the pressure corresponds to a fluctuation the thickness. This is unstable. The instability is going to be at the linearized order of this kind. And in the long wavelength expansion, I can compute what's the relationship between omega and k. This is given by the speed of sound. So what I find is that I get an unstable dispersion relation where I can get the slope here this one. Okay. So in order to do this, the only thing that I've needed to compute is this derivative. Since p and energy density are proportional to each other, this derivative is something that anyone can do without using Mathematica. So that means that I can do it. So I get this slope with almost zero effort. I haven't had to do any calculation. In fact, I can even argue that I can get this the equation of state of this fluid without even knowing the solution for a black brain. I can get it just from assuming that the Einstein vacuum equations have a black string solution. Then by using a scale covariance argument, I can get the equation of state. Out of that equation of state, I get this, and I predict, without even solving the Einstein equations, I predict that this black string is going to be unstable.
Can you get the slope without doing the computation?
Yeah, well, the only computation that I need to do is divide p by epsilon.
But you can predict n plus 1 also.
Yeah, I can predict n plus 1 without having the black string solution. Okay. So, well, we have a. Yes?
Sorry, just this issue of calibration, I don't want to dwell on it. But I think the difference is here you've got a real unstable fluid at the classical level.
Yeah.
You see, I think in cavitation, it's the case where perturbations are stable. But you still have a negative pressure.
Yeah.
But having a negative pressure doesn't mean
okay.
You have a tapping.
So sound waves in the sound waves in the cavitating fluid are stable.
Yes.
Okay, so it's different. Yes. So that's why people don't refer
to
this as
you can have both or
yeah,
only one of the two,
yeah,
or not, or neither.
Yeah. So what the fluid does in this case is that instead of oscillating when you introduce a sound wave, oscillating means that you perform a, well, you have a denser region. This denser region wants to become less dense and back to equilibrium, and that's what normal fluids do. In this case, if you have a denser region, then it clamps more and more. So it gives you an.
How did you get that slope directly from the variable Laplan perturbation equation?
So I got this not from the Laplan perturbation, but from the fluid dynamic
right,
equations. So the equations, I can show that this fluid, I can derive from the Einstein equations, I can derive these equations. These are constraint Einstein equations. So I have equations which are in the radial direction and one of the wall volume directions. These equations imply this. So the Einstein equations imply this. So I'm solving actually Einstein's equations when I'm solving these fluid equations. I solve these fluid equations for a small linear perturbation around the black string, and then I get that, well, I get sound waves which are unstable. Okay? So this is actually solving the Einstein equations in the long wavelength regime. So I'm not doing any analogy nor anything. I'm solving the real Einstein equations, the actual Einstein equations.
Right?
It's a subset. It's the Einstein equations for long wavelength fluctuations.
Okay. Can you argue backward that if you have an unstable solution of C that implies that R also has the instability?
That if I have a,
so you are
an unstable solution of, for any solution of these equations,
can
I can have a full solution, a solution including the bulk of the Einstein equations. For every, that's like in the fluid gravity correspondence, it's exactly the same. Any solution to these equations, to the effective fluid equations, gives me a complete solution to the Einstein equations that is regular on the horizon.
But unless the time evolution takes you out of the approximation
started. At least as long as I'm in the regime of long wavelengths and small frequencies.
Yeah, but gravity might just take you out of
the regime. But at the linearized level, this works. Yeah, eventually, yeah, it may take me away from that regime, and that.
So to get the quadratic type slow, then you would have to go to second order?
So if I include now, so this was at the perfect fluid level, so this is linear in K. If I include a viscous damping, then this curve is going to stop being just like this, it's going to do something like this. Now, if I include these corrections and I include this value for the bulk viscosity, well, the equations that I have to solve, if I write a perturbation then, let me see if I can. The fluid equations at the linearized level, they give me so if I don't have this term, then I recover that equation. Omega is omega. If I don't have this, I recover this. Now if I solve these equations and I expand them to quadratic order, what I get is, well, I think I have it in the, this is the expression that I get. Okay? So this is the expression to quadratic order. This is the linear order, the one that we got just from the perfect fluid. This is including quadratic order. This is the plot of this curve over here. So this is the effective 1+1 fluid. And computing this, you see that the only thing that you need, if you could say that you guess that the bulk viscosity takes this form, which there are general arguments for this, then the only thing that I need to know is the speed of sound. The speed of sound, as I said, I need very little in order to compute it. So I can get this equation just by some well-motivated assumptions and without doing any calculation, essentially doing any calculation. I get these curves. This is the results from the full numerical equations. So this looks pretty good, right?
Does that assume that K times R0 is small?
It assumes that K times R0 is small. So in principle, you should only compare this region to this region. Now, if you do that, well, works pretty good. Dots are numerical results, the other are the. And if you, for some reason, you decide, well, let's try what happens to very large n. Go to a string in 104 dimensions. Red dots are the numerical results. The blue curve is this. I mean, if you tell me that I have no reason to expect that this equation works up to here, the discrepancy here is just 1%. If I go, and we can argue that the discrepancy is going to be 1 over n. So it becomes exact in the limit of infinite number of dimensions. Yes?
Can I be the devil's advocate?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to be the devil's advocate in a moment. Yeah.
You think that the third order correct?
Yeah.
Does it still remain there? Or
people have done it. They haven't published it. So they have the next order coefficients. They have included them here. Then if you include that, then there's no way to distinguish the analytic curve from the...
But does it improve for n equals
1? Not much.
But it doesn't
score
the agreement at low k.
No, no, no. At low k, it becomes even better. But then at larger k, it doesn't get so much better for a small n. For n equals 100, I've seen the plots, and well, it's within numerical error, you're just getting the exact curve.
So your statement is that this is like a convergent series somehow, even though you're evaluating in a regime where approximation completes.
What I'm saying is that for some reason, in the regime of large n, this approximation becomes exact. And one reason that this may be, this is becoming better and better, is that here you have the temperature. The temperature goes, if you fix this thickness, the temperature grows with n, which means that your thermal wavelength is becoming smaller and smaller. And hydrodynamics is an expansion relative to your thermal wavelength. So if the thermal wavelength becomes smaller and smaller, hydrodynamics should be becoming better, should be becoming better and better. This is not an explanation that you should 100% swallow, but I think it's some way along the right interpretation of this disagreement, right? This disagreement. So this is what I said when I think that we have a good hydrodynamic theory for understanding the linear regime of the Gregor-Laplan instability. Okay.
But you still always need the quadratic term, otherwise
yeah,
this would always be linear.
In fact, let me play devil's advocate and saying that we're cheating here, but the reason that we're cheating and we're still trying to sell the point is that there seems to be something going on here, right? So if I take this equation, this is the equation that we get from our hydrodynamics at linear order. Hydrodynamics is never going to give you a zero mode. It cannot, because if you set the velocity to zero, then you don't get any static solution, any non-trivial static solution. And the static solution will have zero velocity. You go to your hydrodynamic equations, you put velocity to zero, you're never going to get a solution that corresponds to something like this. A static solution that has a non-trivial profile, it's never going to come out of your hydrodynamic equations, which you see, if you set omega to zero, well, these equations don't have any solution. What I do is I solve these equations, I expand them to quadratic order, I truncate them to quadratic order, and then I get these curves. But I shouldn't have any reason to trust these results up to here.
Isn't it an order of limits issue between sending the velocity to zero and sending the number of dimensions to infinity?
Well, in this case, it may be, yeah. There's maybe something like that.
Which you do first, you get the right result.
Probably there's something like that, and we're trying to analyze this also. I mean, we could take the full Gregor-Laplan system, where we don't perform any long wavelength expansion, and in those equations, take the large n limit and try to recover this. So Nidal is working on this.
So. If you were to do what you said, and you plot, how would it look?
If
you solve the quadratic equation exactly and put it on the...
What you get is something like this. So something that doesn't turn over. So you get something that goes like this, which is telling you that you don't have the zero mode. And in fact, if you were to evolve these equations, they would be driving you to shorter and shorter frequencies.
Well, but that's not correct to solve that equation exactly, because you're leaving terms out of that equation.
Of course.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So
yeah.
The proper thing to do is to expand it like this.
Yeah, but say that I take my equations, my hydrodynamic equations, and I say, well, I'm going to truncate them, and then I'm going to consider them as my full system, and I want to try to evolve them to see whether I can get something like a nonlinear evolution. Well, there's first of all the problem that you have that this is not a hyperbolic system. But then you may say, well, let's add the other terms which have been computed, and then I'm going to truncate to cubic term. the corner.
But if you add the other terms, you also end up not having a clear correct structure in the equation system.
So in that case, if you do that, if you add the next order terms and then you truncate the equations, you get a hyperbolic system, but still the evolution is going to drive you to shorter and shorter scales. I don't want to say that this is, we've heard about driving to shorter and shorter scales and saying that it's turbulence, but I don't think that we expect any turbulence in here. Just, well, to begin with, because this is a 1+1 system. I don't think that there's a turbulence in 1+1. There's not even room for that.
So what's the agreement at large k for lower n?
Over here for lower it's not so good. So you see, this goes to close to 0.5. This is closer to 0.8.
If you want to include the cubic term,
doesn't get much better. So, I've already said something. So we have the linearized problem. It seems like we understand it well enough that we can have some confidence and try to go nonlinear. Now, this thing, we just discussed the idea that taking this effective system that we have, it's a nonlinear, the equations of hydrodynamics are nonlinear, so that we truncate them to, say, second order hydrodynamics or the next order, I don't think that that's going to give us, if we truncate these equations and then we put them in the computer and evolve them, I don't think that that's going to give us a good model for the evolution of the Gregor Laplan instability, the linear evolution. So, that's something that you can still maybe try to work on, but something that you're going to have less control over. How am I doing? I'm probably.
You have about.
1 minute?
15 minutes.
15 minutes. As many as
that. No, actually, sorry, no, you're out of time.
Yeah, I'm out of time.
You're out of time, but.
I'm just going to say a few things about the attractor and the scaling behavior, okay? Because that's interesting. So, what people do in fluid dynamics in order to study. So they have also done a 1+1 reduction. So we started here from the black string. We performed this long wavelength approximation, and then we get an effective 1+1 theory that looks like a fluid. Now, in fluid dynamics, they do something very similar. So they take their fluid jet, introduce a long wavelength fluctuation. They do it in a different way than we do it. They don't say that they're doing a derivative expansion, but this is what they're really doing. But the equations, well, they make them look a little different than what we do. But eventually, what they get is a 1+1 system of equations for long wavelength fluctuations of this tube. Okay. Surprisingly enough, they don't interpret this, even if they could, as a 1+1 fluid. But I've never seen them saying that. They start with their fluid column, and then they get a 1+1 effective fluid. They get a 1+1 system of equations. They could just rewrite it as the equations of a 1+1 fluid, but they don't do it. I don't know why. The thing is that this system of equations that they find here, this is, in fact, the basis for their theory of a drop formation. So if you study this system of equations, the variables that you have, one of them is, well, they don't use R0. They call this the height of your profile. The height is from the middle. This is going to be a function of T and Z. They have the velocity. Fluid is a function of T and Z. So they get a set of equations for this. And
they have the radial and Z velocity.
Yeah, so the radial and Z velocity, they have been integrated out in a sense. Okay. So just like in the case of the black string, we integrate the radial direction, and this is what we call holography, that the radial direction is integrated out, and then you get a 1 plus 1 system of equations. They do something, it's the same, they solve for the radial equations, and they eliminate it and write everything in terms of these collective coordinates for these fluctuations. Okay. So what they realize is that these equations, you can find solutions that exhibit continuous self-similarity. What this means is that you can write these equations in terms of variables that depend on only a combination of T and Z. So if you introduce for H a function like T over 1/2 and B equals so the idea here is that you want to describe the approach to a point where the height of this fluid column becomes smaller and smaller, the velocity becomes larger and larger. So you want to describe that's shrinking in terms of a function of only one variable. The scaling variable is C over T over 1/2. I write here T. This is T goes to zero is the point where the string pinches down to zero size. So you plug this ansatz, you can say that this is an ansatz that I take from my equations. I write it, I plug it in the equations. I find that everything that the T dependence drops out. The equations only depend on this scaling variable that I have over here. So you get a set of equations for this height and this velocity. So you've turned your system from PDEs to ODEs. Now you try to solve them. You can solve them numerically. And then you find you find that there's a solution that looks like this. So this is this coordinate psi, and this would be phi. Now the existence of this solution, which is a scaling solution, which means that as t goes to zero, you're getting also to smaller and smaller regions. So this is scaling down. T goes to zero, this means that your longitudinal directions are also shrinking. So the system is scaling. This solution that they find, you find it at some value of t. Then at a later value of t, you find the same solution, but shrunk by the factor of the square root of the time that has elapsed. Okay. So what you find is at some point, you find something like this. At a later point, you find something like this. At a later point, you find something like this. So you have continuous self-similarity, and eventually, as t goes to zero, what you have is that the height has shrunk to zero, velocity has gone to infinity, the velocity goes, the profile for the velocity, so you have velocity going in this direction and in this direction, so the velocity is positive this side and negative this side. And what this attractor, what they claim that this is describing, is precisely the formation of this neck. So this is the big blob, this is the tube. This region is described by this attractor self-similar solution. And this goes to zero, and that describes the approach to the singularity, yes?
So that scaling came out of their equation, but
it's something that you can find. I mean, you can look for scaling solutions. So you write an ansatz in terms of things that depend on only one variable. You put some exponents, and then you try to see what how you fit these exponents. So in the equations, the variables z and t as separate variables disappear, but the equations depend eventually on only this.
But the question was going to be, I mean, their equations and your fluid dynamics was somehow the same. Can you point at the fluid dynamics or the stress tensor and say, you know, that's where that scaling came from because of some...
I'm not sure whether, I mean, the fluid equations, non-relativistic Navier-Stokes equations for an incompressible fluid have a scaling property, a scaling symmetry. So this is kind of related to that scaling symmetry, but it goes in the opposite direction. The, it's your scaling.
You have a different kind of fluid. So
no, I mean, it's what the. This is just for the non-relativistic Navier-Stokes equations for an incompressible fluid, right? So I'm talking about the fluid dynamics only. I'm not talking about. Are you asking whether I'm applying this to?
Well, I wanted to see if there was a connection between their fluids and their pinching off and your.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Okay. Not yet. Okay. So this is the basis for the theory of drop formation.
Yeah. Navier-Stokes equation, but I thought you said the surface tension was important.
Well, the surface tension disappears in the 1 plus 1 system of equations. So when they take the slender jet approximation, that's right.
Your interpretation of the equation.
So they get a 1 plus 1 system of equations. In this case, it's non-relativistic, but this is a system that has different, so it has an effective pressure, an effective energy density, and an effective viscosity that are not the same as the parameters of your initial fluid tube. This is a 1 plus 1 effective fluid. And here we get also a 1 plus 1 effective fluid. And our hope, our expectation, is that this is going to exhibit also the same or some similar behavior, similar attractor behavior close to this pinch-off point.
So these powers are just what you expect in non-relativistic. This one half
versus linear here, that's non-relativistic.
And it's also in diffusion, I guess, which is the same reason.
Probably so, yeah.
Should I think of the evolution going from minus infinity and, I mean...
Yeah. Or from infinity here they take, so
right,
t,
from negative
t is actually t0 minus t, where t0 is the time of a pinch off. So that's why I'm putting absolute value, right? So this is a time, so you're going from minus infinity to time equal zero, time equal t0. Now, yes.
But the system had a z to minus z symmetry, right? And now you're saying the solution.
The solution is not symmetric. And in fact, you don't want it to be symmetric because this configuration is not symmetric. This they compare to. So this is a comparison between this analytical result or this, well, semi-analytic because this you solve numerically, but you massage the system to analytic system and set of ODEs. So this is the solution from this attractor and this is experiment. And the picture, the orange thing, that's experiment. So you see that the fit is really excellent. At some point, of course, it breaks down. And here there's no parameter that you adjust. You just take the time to pinch off, and that fixes everything. So the fact that you can get this with this accuracy, I think this means that they've really pinned down the theory of this breakup.
Okay. After the breakup, does it go to that one, but we keep up with the...
So after breakup, one has to, well, I don't think I have right now the time to describe what happens after breakup because you have to modify the equations a little bit. Everything is cleanest before breakup. After breakup, you have to tweak a little bit the equations, but they also seem to find an excellent agreement.
So this is a function of time. So how close to breakup can you get with the approximation?
Well, I think in this case, this is a matter of experiment. If you want to compare to experiment at some point, I don't know. They are on the order of microseconds. I don't know how far they can go experimentally.
So, Robert, here the properties of the fluid don't enter?
Yes. Well, no. I mean, that's scaled away. This is universal.
Yeah, but it's...
Everything is measured in terms of so your viscosity and other parameters. They give you some natural length scales. And then everything is measured in those units. And that's why this is universal. So once you've taken, you know what the viscosity of your fluid is, what the surface tension of your fluid is. This is giving you some units. When you express things in those units, this is why, I mean, you don't have any adjustable parameters. You take the parameters of the fluid and measured in the units that are natural to the fluid, everything is. So this is a universal attractor for jet breakup.
But then measuring those units, wouldn't you expect this to break down when the gradients of velocities, for example, become more than one?
That's very good, because this approximation, this is a slender jet approximation, one can show that it becomes exact for the full theory, for the full hydrodynamic theory. Then eventually, so I have two levels of hydrodynamic theory. I have my fluid tube, and I have my 1+1 description. For the equations for the fluid tube with the boundary and everything, this solution, this is exact. That's, it's not that it's only going to work in this long wavelength approximation. It turns out that the attractor is an exact solution of the full hydrodynamics. Then, of course, at some point, hydrodynamics is going to break down, and then, well, molecular dynamics will take over.
So that solution, you call you continue, is a straight line?
It's not straight line. It's goes to infinity in some way. I don't know. Well, that's computed numerically. I don't think there's any analytical expression, but I think it's a bit subtle. It's not a straight line, and this is not a straight line. I think I'll probably stop here. I mean, because I mean, our goal is now to find this self-similar behavior in the equations for our 1+1 system. And in that case, if we achieve that, and that's not completely easy because we have a relativistic system. Here, velocity is going to infinity. In our relativistic system, you don't want the velocities to go to infinity. You may want rapidities to go to infinity. So you have to write to find the right variables for the scaling. But
I try looking at this system now but relativistic and see if you can render the equations in similar form.
We have done we have extended all they have done for this non-relativistic three-dimensional fluid, incompressible fluid. We have extended it to arbitrary number of dimensions, incompressible fluids, relativistic ones. So we have a kind of a general framework for addressing this, and scaling in some cases that depends on the equation of state of your fluid. If you want the equation of state of your fluid that scales, this has to be a polytropic fluid. Polytropic equations of state have scaling properties, right? Because you have that rho energy density, that's what I would call maybe here epsilon, is or pressure is epsilon to some polytropic exponent, right? So you have a scaling behavior for at least some equation of state. In other cases, or at least if your fluid doesn't approach a polytropic behavior in some regime, then you wouldn't expect scaling.
So right, so here you have pressure from the same sign of energy, whether on this front, on this other side, you don't have that, right? So
you have no. I mean, the 1+1, so this is the pressure of the fluid jet. The 1+1 system that they have also a negative speed of sound, because that's the long wavelength regime of the Gregor-Lafan stability. So that's not a problem.
And in his numerical solutions, can you see that all the necks have the same shape?
Well, the numerical solutions, I mean, this is a solution that's universal. It doesn't depend.
No, in his
solutions. Oh, in his solutions. Oh, that's what I want them to look into in more detail.
We looked at
a similar kind of bump that you see in that solution.
It looks like they have something like this, but it's hard because that's a region where. But I did ask them to check whether they could find this kind of scaling, but it's not that easy.
But I think you have to look away from the horizon as well. I mean, it's not.
I'm not sure why. I mean, you have to. I mean, we're measuring everything in terms of the size of the horizon. Their function h is what we're calling R0.
No, but wouldn't you expect there's some scaling geometry, not just on the horizon, but away from the horizon?
I would expect it around, in a region around this.
Yeah, so I mean, it's quite difficult to know how to do that.
I mean, the first thing that you would try to do is to see whether you have just scaling behavior or scaling of the neck, because the rate at which the point where the neck is thinnest, this scales in a linear way that you could try to see whether you have this. And they have something like this, right? You have something like a linear scaling of the thickness of the neck. So that's a good indication. It would be also good to see what the velocity does, whether the velocity scales also in some way, or whether not only the minimum of the curve, but all the curve, whether it scales in a self-similar way. I think, you've had enough. More than enough.
Yeah, let's thank Roberto.